Welcome to the Off the Page podcast from Franciscan Media, a podcast featuring Franciscan conversations with authors, artists, and educators. My name is Stephen Copeland, and I am Franciscan Media's book editor. Our next guest on the podcast is author and blogger Mark Shea. Mark is the author of the St. Anthony Messenger's September cover story titled The Dangers of Christian Nationalism. Mark is a longtime contributor to the St. Anthony Messenger, often taking on challenging topics that are facing Catholics today. Mark lives in Washington State with his wife Janet, their sons, and grandkids. His book, The Church's Best Kept Secret, A Primer on Catholic Social Teaching, was published in September 2020 by New City Press. You can learn more about Mark's work at markpshea.com. A couple quick things before we get started. Mark and I did experience some technical difficulties with the video, not the audio. The audio sounds great. But if you do enjoy this podcast on YouTube, that is why there is no full-length video on that platform. And lastly, this episode features some hot topic issues, which is what we want with this podcast. We want these conversations to be relevant, relatable, and to make you think. And we welcome a diversity of thought on this podcast. Francis himself modeled that you can have heart-to-heart connections with people and not always agree. And that's the fun of this, experiencing Christ in each other. So with that being said, I hope you really enjoy this episode. It's a fun one. And even if you don't agree with everything that is said, I think it'll make you think critically about the social and political climate we're navigating. Here is Mark Shea. Thank you again for joining the Off the Page podcast.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So your September cover story in the St. Anthony Messenger addresses Christian nationalism. For starters here, what is Christian nationalism and why did you want to write about it?
Christian nationalism is, I would describe Christian nationalism as a heresy that is to the Christian's relationship with the state as the sin of pride is to the Christian's relationship with himself, if you will. We are commanded, the two great commandments that we have from our Lord are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, to love your neighbor as yourself. What Christian nationalism teaches is kind of a photographic negative of that. So the command to love your neighbor as yourself has various applications. So we apply that, you know, to our families, of course. And we also, we continue to extend the boundary of what it means to be a neighbor to our fellow citizens. And, you know, that makes sense. So you could say that patriotism, for example, is the love of neighbor extended to your borders. What Christian nationalism does is it weirdly perverts that command to love neighbor into an excuse for hating those who are not citizens of your country. So it's the sin of pride. What made the devil the devil was the sin of pride. And what does the devil do? Well, you know, pride loves the self above all else. And you can turn other people into extensions of the ego in that way. So we saw, for, you know, its most extreme example that we saw came in the 20th century in Hitler's Germany, where Hitler turns the German people into the extension of his own ego. And then uses that, weaponizes that against the rest of the world. And yet, what we saw at the end of World War II, of course, was that as Hitler loses the war, what's revealed, of course, is that the German people never meant anything to him. And so he's ready to just, you know, burn it all down because the German people failed me, is Hitler's attitude to this. And so Christian nationalism, the grave danger of Christian nationalism, is that it perverts these commands to love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, mind, and all of your mind and all of your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. It perverts them into turning the nation into an extension of the ego of the Christian nationalism, and in fact, turning God into an extension of the ego of the Christian nationalist. Why does the Christian nationalist love God? Because God's going to make us big and powerful. And as long as he comes through, that's the contract which, you know, God has never signed. This is something that the Christian nationalist brandishes and says, this is how it's going to be. God is on our side. All who are not us. And of course, in the mind of the Christian nationalist, the not us includes not simply foreigners, people at the border, etc. It also means any countryman who is not part of the Christian nationalist sect. That's how this is played out. And so what Christian nationalism inevitably attempts to do is impose what it calls gospel values by the one means that St. Paul absolutely guarantees can never possibly work, which is by means of the law. Paul, if there's anything that Paul bangs away at more than anything, it is that we cannot be saved by law. That is not how grace works. We are saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ. We are not saved by forcing people to live usually by the fragments of a moral code that we don't keep ourselves, and which, as we're seeing, as we've seen recently in attempts, for example, to Louisiana, is trying to stick the Ten Commandments into schoolrooms. Why? Well, it's performative piety. It's, look at us. We're standing for Christian values. Okay, goody for you. But, while you're doing that, of course, as Paul tells the Romans, you who oppose idols, do you rob temples? And so, at the same time, that there's this attempt to impose fragments of law on people who perhaps see no particular reason to revere the Ten Commandments because they're not Jews, they're not Christians, or whatever, what's being accomplished there is some Buddhist parent with kids in the classroom gonna come away from that going, wow, okay, I believe. Of course not, And so the key to this use of law in the hands of Christian nationalism is that the law is understood by the Christian nationalists to bind the people that they want to have the boot on their neck, and to exempt those who are imposing the law. And so this whole attempt to impose by law, force, fear, razor wire, threats of deportation, descriptions of their enemies as vermin, and this is a historically resonant phrase that also takes us back to Hitler's Germany, people who are poisoning the blood of our country. All of this is a grotesque perversion of the gospel. I'm coming at all of this not from the perspective of, although one certainly can, but I'm coming at it not from the perspective of our heritage as Americans and the need for the Constitution to apply to all and so on and so forth, and the president, God help us, not to be immune from having to obey the Constitution. That's a very serious problem. But for me, as a Christian and as a Catholic who understands what the teaching of the gospel is, I'm coming at this from the perspective that this is a deadly, deadly dangerous heresy and a perversion of Christian teaching. You know, so it's evil because of that. It's also evil, of course, because the guaranteed outcome from this Faustian bargain, this deal with the devil, is going to be the destruction of the church and the witness of the church in the United States. Absolutely guaranteed. No question about it. And so, you know, I believe that it's incumbent on us as Christians to bear witness to the gospel against this profoundly dangerous notion of Christian nationalism.
You hit on it a little bit. I'm wondering, what is it about Christian nationalism? What is it in this ideology that makes it so psychologically appealing to people?
It's one of the primal temptations. It's the third temptation of the Christ faced in the wilderness. All this will I give you if you will bow down and worship me. The devil takes Jesus up to an exceeding high mountain and shows him all the kingdoms of the earth, and says, all this has been given to me and I can give it to whoever I want. All this I will give to you if you'll bow down and worship me. What could be simpler? This has been a standing temptation. The reason that we're told about those temptations is because the four great idols of human history have always been money, pleasure, power, and honor. And Christian nationalist leaders always promise those things, as nationalist leaders always promise those things, because the active word in Christian nationalism is always nationalism. It's not really about the gospel. It's just, you know, you're a Christian, you come from a Christian background, you're used to Christian culture, so, you know, we'll add in a dollop of this feels familiar to you. And you get to have these familiar things that remind you of your culture, your home, and whatever. But the real goal is always money, pleasure, power, honor. And that's what the appeal of Christian nationalism is. And that's what the temptations were about. The temptations were temptations to, you're hungry. You want to fill your belly? Great. Turn these stones into bread. You know, you're worried about your security. Terrific. You know, I will make it so that you can throw yourself off the temple and you won't get hurt. Nothing can hurt you. You'll be fine. And the last great temptation is bow down and worship me, and I will give you power. And this is exactly, I mean, this is literally the words, you know, that the biggest Christian nationalist threat in our history has been promising ever since 2016. When I am in power, Christianity will be powerful again. The primal heresy in Christian history is the Arian heresy. This is the great heresy that occasioned the first ecumenical council in the history of the church. And how did Arianism work? Arianism took the most important thing that the Christian gospel had to offer us, the glory of God the Father, and weaponized that against the rest of the gospel, weaponized it against the deity of God the Son, weaponized it later against the deity of the Holy Spirit. And because the glory of God is a really good thing, it was easy for people who sort of developed this mania around this one truth to reject all the other truths that the faith also gives us, including the truth that Jesus is God, that, you know, that the Son is God, that the Holy Spirit is God. And so that's what the council had to settle. And every time Catholics tried to speak to Arians, of course, Arians said, "You are attacking the glory of God the Father. You are an enemy of God. You are not a friend of God." Because what happens with a heresy always is that one truth or a small cluster of real truths from the tradition become infected and inflamed and turned into this crazy, like a cancerous tumor that attacks the rest of the body. And that's what happened with the Arian heresy. And so what the church calls us to do, the church says, pay attention to the entire common good. So work against the death penalty as well as working to protect the unborn. What drives our abortion rates is and always has been demand, not supply. And the reason for the demand is economic. Poverty is the number one abortifacient in the United States. If you want to lower abortion rates, then you attack poverty. So we wind up being turned one against another. And this is one of the classic ways in which the person who is playing on the Christian nationalist nerve works his audience so that their anger gets directed toward their enemies, their imagined enemies, the burger flipper who somehow is a threat to the poorly paid soldier, who somehow is a threat to the poorly paid cop, who somehow is a threat to, you know, the ambulance driver. The burger didn't do anything. He's not paying their wages or refusing to pay their wages. He's just trying to get by. And so this way of turning people against one another while at the same time sort of pulling them in and saying, if you stick with me, I will make you powerful. You're going to be one of my lieutenants. You're going to be one of my fellow alpha wolves. And together, you and I are going to defeat all these enemies that you are so angry at. It's a psychological ploy that has worked for centuries and centuries. It's at the foundation of American racism as well. It's one of the classic ways in which wealthy slave owners told poor whites, for example, in the South, if you don't help out, these black slaves are going to get free and they're going to come after you. Now, that same method is being used. If you don't side with me, who will make you powerful, those brown people are going to come across the border. They're going to take all of your jobs. They're going to, you know, they're going to kill your daughter and all the rest of it. This is a strategy that has worked again and again and again. And all you have to do is just find a scapegoat group. And this is how Christian nationalism always works. This is how nationalism always works.
You mentioned this a little bit earlier. Can you describe the difference between patriotism and nationalism? A lot of conservatives feel like the far left is very anti-American at times in their rhetoric. But then patriotism at the same time, if I'm hearing you correctly, it seems like it can drift into nationalism. So can you help, make a distinction between those two and explain how it drifts into the other?
The distinction is always between love, which is legitimate, mm-hmm. as long as it's rightly ordered, and pride, which is never, in Christian understanding, a good thing. The problem is that in English, of course, pride can often be used as a synonym for love. So I'm proud of my son. He did a great job. He got his PhD. I'm proud of him. That's not the sin of pride. That's in English, that's just another way of saying I love my son. And love in that sense is always fine. You know, it's healthy, of course. So the two great commandments that we are given is to love God and to love neighbor. And so patriotism is a healthy expression of love, just as love for family, when it's rightly ordered, is a healthy expression of love as well. Self-love can be, Jesus loved himself. Why wouldn't he? He's God. He's perfectly good. And so we're commanded to love our neighbors as ourselves. And so all of that is legitimate. And so there are different ways in which that's played out. It's played out in the family. It's played out among friends. It's played out toward your neighbors, which is, rightly understood, can be applied to your country. So we owe our country huge debts that we'll never be able to repay. I didn't create our constitutional order. That was established for me and defended for me by generations that lived and died before I was born. I owe them a debt that I can't repay. And so the way we live that out is we pay it forward. We pay it to our children. We pay it to our neighbors. We try to hand them a better country than the one that we were born into. But it doesn't stop at our borders. The great model of this that we're given is the parable of the Good Samaritan, because that's exactly the question that's brought to Jesus, is who is my neighbor? And what the answer that Jesus gives at the end of the day is everyone is your neighbor. Everyone is your neighbor. Yeah. So we are called to love everybody. And Jesus is so radical about this that he says that we are to love even our enemies. The shocking thing for Jesus's listeners when he tells us the parable of the Good Samaritan is that there was no love lost between Samaritans and Jews in the first century. There was all kinds of historical bitterness, stuff that, went back centuries. And it was, it was ethnic bitterness and it was religious bitterness, all kinds of hostility going on there on both sides. Nobody on either side liked each other. And because he's really trying to drive home to us the fact that blood kinship is not the determinant of who we're supposed to love. which was, of course, a huge driver in antiquity and remains a huge driver today. And when you wind up making the second greatest commandment more important than the first greatest commandment, when you start narrowing the definition of who your neighbor is to your ethnic kin and blood, that's when you are preparing to turn the world into hell on earth. You've taken something that really is part of the Christian tradition, as all heresy is, and then you've weaponized it. And one of the deadliest things that a Christian can do is glom onto one part of the Christian tradition and turn it into a cancerous tumor that attacks the rest. And this is what Christian nationalism always does, because it's what nationalism does. What nationalism does is it takes the ethnos, the blood kin, the pride of the nation in our family, our kind, and weaponizes it against all the rest of the human beings who have a perfect right to, you know, live and to be who they are, and their particular ways of life, and so on and so forth. And what Christian nationalism does is it says we're doing this for God. And so anyone who opposes us opposes God. That combination, incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, and I think a big thing is that you get to be right. And I see this in some aspects of progressive Christianity too. You did mention one thing, you know, that the two greatest commandments that Jesus gives us, it pulls up, they pull us deeper into our conversion in relationship with the other. The neighbor is not who I decide is my neighbor, someone who looks like me, acts like me, votes like me, believes like me. The neighbor is the person that shatters all of my constructs. And I think this may be a strategic time to bring in someone like St. Francis of Assisi, who his entire Christian conversion, some would argue, deepened in relationship with the other. Whether it is the leper, you know, these people that were outcast in that society, and Francis is called deeper and deeper and deeper into loving and accepting and eventually sharing a meal from the same bowl with a leper and hugging them. And then same thing with the Sultan Malik al-Kamil, where he thinks he's going to go give the Sultan the answer. Nope. In a very real way, Francis was animated by his own fundamentalism, his own certainty, thinking he's going to go convert the Sultan. And the opposite happens. The heart ruptures everything that he thought was absolutely true. There's something there, I think, in the time that we're navigating that I think it's important to elevate. What's your interpretation of how St. Francis and his legacy and his spiritual trajectory can help us right now in something like Christian nationalism? Or do you see some similarities between the times he was navigating and the times that we're navigating right now?
Well, Francis, of course, is living in a world, at least in his local world, he's living in a world where literally everybody, except for small communities of Jews, everyone in Western Europe is a Catholic. And yet, of course, what's also ironically true is he's living in you know, a Europe that's riven by all kinds of little regional wars and that kind of thing. You've still got power struggles, you know, Game of Thrones kind of stuff going on. And, you know, Italy is broken up into little nation states that are all fighting with each other and that sort of thing. But it's a time in which everybody in Europe lives even if they live in a patchwork political quilt, they live in the same universe. And the big challenge to that universe is the rise of Islam. And so that's where you get things like, you know, Francis going off to convert the Sultan and that sort of thing. But there's a terrific book by an English historian. He's not a believer himself, a guy named Tom Holland. He wrote a book called Dominion, which I highly recommend, in which he makes this that the gospel was a colossal depth charge at the foundations of classical civilization, and that within 1,000 years of the foundation of the church, it had ignited the first revolution in European history, which was the reforms of Gregory the VII, in which concepts like separation of church and state, which, you know, we take for granted in the United States, that's part of the Catholic legacy to the West, and that the chief thing that the Christian Revolution that the Christian Revolution has done is it's set off a series of concussive revolutions that have formed our modern world, that were ironically they're profoundly based in Christian theology, and at the same time have become reactions against Christianity. So reform movements in the 14th century that led into the Protestant Reformation, which was itself taking for granted certain aspects of the Christian tradition in order to attack the Catholic Church. The Enlightenment did the same thing. Revolts like communism did the same thing. Communism takes for granted things that are in no way evident, you know, from the sciences or the senses, the dignity of the little guy, you know, that somehow the future lies with the slave and not with the slave owner. All of these kinds of things are all, you know, they go back to his cast down the mighty in their arrogance and lifted up the lowly. And we're still seeing that today. And so one of the ironies that strikes me again and again is that people on the left beg and plead with people who announce themselves to be devout conservative Christians to be like Jesus. That's ironically, it's the people who often view themselves as opposed to the church, opposed to the Christian tradition, who their anger is the anger of frustrated lovers who want to see, who really want to see the Christian tradition lived out with, you know, mercy for the least of these and care for the least of these and so forth. And that weird schism that we're living in is something that Francis didn't have to contend with. He didn't live in a universe that was fragmented in that way. He lived in a universe that was fragmented politically. It was fragmented for straightforward stuff about, that's my piece of turf and I want your stuff. You know, you get that kind of thing. But so it's weird how it has reconfigured itself, and yet the same answers that Francis looks to: humility before God, humility before neighbor, care for the least of these, looking to love even your enemy, which is a huge challenge. I mean, because, of course, people like me who are mortally opposed to Christian nationalism have it incumbent on us to love Christian nationalists. We have to figure out a way to do that. And, you know, how that is to be done is, I think, is a daily challenge. I think I do it poorly. It's difficult, you know, to love people who gloat over cruelty. We're all looking for some way that we can give in to money, pleasure, because anger is a pleasure. It's like, I can cut loose with all the self-control stuff that I have to do in order to rein in my anger, and I can really just indulge myself. That's a form of pleasure to which our culture is prey, because the four great idols, this cannot be said enough, are money, pleasure, power, and honor. What the gospel teaches us to do is restrain all those appetites and turn that energy over toward the love of God and the love of neighbor. And that is steady work. That's what Francis did. You know, he practiced the kinds of austerities that were the way you reined in those appetites in that time. So, no, we are not required to go barefoot in the snow, you know, and practice those kinds of austerities that Francis chose to do. But what we are absolutely required to do, as Francis did, was refuse to give in to these wild animal appetites for money, pleasure, power, and honor, and to turn our direction toward, as best we can, loving God above all things and loving our neighbors as ourselves, and never pitting those two commandments against one another, and never pitting the second commandment, placing it over the first commandment. The first commandment has to rein in the second commandment.
And one of the things theologically for Francis, I think it would be very apt to bring this in to the Christian nationalist conversation, is that the Franciscan approach to the incarnation is, some may say it was countercultural in that day, where at a time where, not all across the board, but Jesus was very often depicted, or the divine was very often depicted as, you know, this being on a throne, glorified, who is, you know, and you can kind of
royal.
Yeah, you can almost make a direct link to a justification for something like the Crusades, when that is your God view. And again, I know it's way more nuanced and complex than that, but when your God is this king on a throne, I mean, you want to join the army, you know. But for Francis, it was the opposite. And for Francis, what invited him into this lifestyle of charity and love and self-emptying was the humble God, the God who enters in.
Right.
The God that incarnates God's self in this little baby that cries and pees and poops. How radically humble is the trajectory of this God? And that's that's very different. I think a lot of it, like theologically, when it comes to Christian nationalism, it's like, what's your God metaphor? Is it a God on a throne that's saying, this is the way? If you don't join this team, well, one, join the team and you're going to be right and certain and you're going to attain power and glory. And if you don't, you're an enemy, you know, that kind of binary. And then whereas the humble God that Francis fell in love with, it just shatters all your binaries.
Right. Well, and this is one of the things that Tom Holland talks about, is that, you know, there, the, there was an enormously popular, it was the fastest growing cult devoted to the worship of a son of God. In the first century, it was the worship of Augustus Caesar. The cult of Augustus Caesar was hugely popular in the first century. It was, you know, people ascending to godhood. That happened a lot in the first century. You know, Julius Caesar raised to godhood his heir, Octavius Caesar, who becomes Augustus Caesar. You know, same thing, right? And of course, what a god looked like in the first century was he's the guy that's able to crucify people. He's the guy that's able to have them burned alive or beheaded. You know, the whole point of crucifixion in the first century was that it instilled Stockholm syndrome in its victims so that the victims of crucifixion, or the people who were standing near the victims of crucifixion, identified with the crucifier rather than with the crucified. That I don't, you know, and that was what crucifixion was supposed to do. And we see that in the Gospels. So, you know, the not just the crowd is jeering at Jesus, but even the guys who are crucified with him are jeering at Jesus. I may be crucified and a loser, but at least I'm not as much of a loser as he is. That's what crucifixion was designed to do. And the staggering thing about the rise of Christianity in the first century, and the thing that Holland is gobsmacked by, he's a historian of ancient Rome and Greece, and of these sort of, you know, tyrannosaur predators of the ancient world and how they operated, is that the figure of a crucified God could come to upend the entire Roman order. That staggered. He says that is beyond weird, you know, because there was nobody in the ancient world who was ready to say, yeah, you know, crucifixion, that's a real honor. And it's still the same thing today, that Christ calls us to identify with the losers. Jesus becomes a loser. And it is through that kind of weakness that the gospel triumphs.
Yes.
And that is a tall order. That is a very difficult thing to say yes to. Because, you know, that means those awful people win. And really win. Yeah. And can there really be any hope after that? The promise of the resurrection is there is hope after that, that it doesn't end there. And that God really can defeat the powers of hell. But it doesn't happen through, you know, taking the one ring for yourself and destroying Sauron by becoming Sauron. Not how it happens. And that is hard, hard.
It is. Well, this kind of goes back to something you mentioned earlier, the whole scapegoating mechanism, where I heard one theologian say, and I forget who said it, but something along the lines of the crucifixion, basically it reveals that scapegoating doesn't work and that it should never happen again. Here's God being scapegoated. Right. So it's almost like if you're if you find yourself a part of some kind of Christian ideology on the left or right that gets all its energy from scapegoating still,
right,
you're almost going against the very trajectory of the tradition you claim to follow.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's a hard temptation to resist. You know,
it is. It feels good. It feels really
good. It does. Sure.
To make an other and to scapegoat them. I have to remember Francis's humble God and be like, there's goodness in this person that I completely disagree with. And
right. They
have something to teach me somehow, yeah. Some way, even if we're ultimately still going to disagree. And I'm still going to say, like, Christian nationalism is a huge threat. Can I see that the person that has been duped by this thing is still, you know, doing the best that he or she can in some way? Can I see goodness rising up even in a place that I don't understand? And again, that's not to dismiss it and say it's not a big deal. That's even more of a reason to talk about it, is because now you can talk about it because you're trying to see the humanity in that person that you disagree with very
well. And it's, you know, getting back to my bailiwick, it's good theology. Good theology. American politics loves Manichaeism. You know, this side is all white and this side is nothing but black. And Christianity refuses to do that. Christianity is so radical on this point, it even refuses to say that Satan is nothing but pure evil, because Satan is a creature and therefore made by God, and therefore to the degree that he retains existence, that he retains intellect, that he retains will, these are all good things that God made. And yes, they can be corrupted, but if any being is purely evil, it would cease to exist, because existence is a good. And so Christian theology is very subtle on this point. And one of the results of it, as a priest friend of mine pointed out to me, which, again, this is one of those things like loving your enemies that it's just, I hated having to admit the truth of this because it just makes my life harder. But the reality is that he said, we often speak of someone who does evil. We say of them that the mask is off, that now we see what they're really made of when they do some evil thing. He says that is lousy theology, particularly lousy theology in the confessional. He says the reality is human beings are made in the image and likeness of God, and so at root, along with all other things that God has made, they are good. And there's, yes, of course, they're fallen. And when they sin, as Augustine puts it, they assert their nothingness. But when people come into the confessional and confess their sins, that's when the mask comes off. It's when their sin is forgiven and they enter into at least an attempted state of grace. They may be very bad at it, as are we all. But that's when the mask comes out. And when you walk out of the confessional, you're showing your true face. Your true face is when you are most truly the creature that God has made you to be, not when you put a mask on, because sin anonymizes. You know, one of the remarkable things about the great sinners of history is at the end of the day, how boring they are. You know, Stalin famously remarked that one death is a tragedy and a million deaths is a statistic. That when you lose touch with your humanity, you lose touch with what makes you interesting. Great saints are endlessly fascinating because you know, they were fully human. And so that temptation, that Manichaean temptation, is something that really wants to work against that. You know, my enemy is nothing but X, Y, and Z. And believe me, I fall prey to that temptation as much as anybody does. It is so easy to do, because what you want to do is you want to hurry past this threat and get to the good stuff that the future will surely bring once this threatening person is brushed out of the way.
And that's exactly Francis's story, where it's like, okay, hurry past the leper. You know, don't look at the leper, hurry past.
Don't look at him.
You know,
yeah.
God's tugging him, you know. No, get off your horse, give the leper an offering. No, that's not enough either. Look the leper in the eyes and give the leper the offering. That's not enough either. Hug the leper, embrace the leper, kiss the leper, share a meal with the leper. Let the leper become your brother in Christ. Actually, it's even more radical than that. It's, will you let yourself become the leper's brother in Christ? Because the leper has it more figured out than you have it figured out.
Yeah.
You know, like that's it flips everything on its head. And I think that's what something like the incarnation should do, is it should just completely obliterate all your categories. And that's not to say that there's not a time for debate, or there's not a time for justice, or there's not a time to take a stand. There absolutely is. But then you let the incarnation obliterate your categories again. It's like that person's trying, or that person's wounded, and that's why they were duped for some kind of radical ideology. The Franciscan invitation, again, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. It's to get back to the heart. That's one of the bad things I think about social media, is that it just plays in the realm of ideas for the most part. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Franciscan invitation is, get back to your heart. When you get back to the heart, you're going to find more in common with the person that's most different than you realize.
Well, you know, somebody once said that, you know, the Congregationalist model of church is like-minded people getting together to talk about being like-minded. The Catholic model of the church is and always has been, you know, this giant block party of people with nothing in common except one thing, the Mass. And that's it. And God seems to like the block party thing, since he's, you know, called together people from every, you know, nation, language, tribe, and tongue, as Revelation puts it. I mean, it's right there in the label, Catholic. So the church's way of living community, I think, is one of the great sort of built-in strengths to the faith. There have been in the church's history, mostly because of historical accidents, you wind up with ethnic churches because everyone in your village is Italian and all you've got is an ox cart, so you're not going too far, you know. But also, in the history of the church, especially because the church was born in the Roman Empire, which was it was just this maelstrom of ethnicities, you know, all moving around in what the Romans called our sea, which is a great way to, you know, mix up a lot of different people. You wound up with huge mixtures right from the get-go. Paul is always writing to a multi-ethnic church. What Paul's dealing with in the early church is the fact that the church is multi-ethnic.
Well, you put that verse in your article. It's Galatians 3:28. There's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither slave nor free. There's neither male nor female. For you are all one in Christ Jesus.
Right. And one of the great happy accidents of the American experiment is that we have, just because of our historical circumstances, not because there was any human plan behind it, we have wound up with a profoundly multi-ethnic, to that degree, deeply Catholic country. Not because it's religiously Catholic or denominationally yep. Catholic, but because we have, as a people, had to figure out how to live together. One of the great things that I deeply object to about Christian nationalism is this myth that there's something called a real American, you know, who is white and male and rich. And then there are people who are not real Americans, you know. Chesterton remarked that America was, he described it as a nation with the soul of a church. And he said that because he said, if you want to become American, all you have to do is sign off on a creed, which is that's how you become a Catholic too. Signing off on a creed, you know, do you think these things? Yes. Okay. Good enough. You're an American now. That approach it holds a lot of opportunities for us, I think, as American Catholics, because it takes away many of the ethnic hatreds that, for example, have afflicted Europe for, you know, centuries. Immigrants come here, and a lot of those ethnic hatreds vanish. So you get, you know, the heirs of Frenchmen who came here voting for a German named Eisenhower. And nobody in, you know, 1952 is going, he's a German. Nobody is thinking that. They conceive of Eisenhower as an American because his ties to his German ancestry just don't matter. And that happens again and again. And I think that it's a place where our Catholic heritage that says there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave nor free, male nor female, can be an assist to living in community as Americans. Although, of course, the goal and point of the Catholic faith is not, and never has been, and never will be, we have to keep this America thing going forever. America is not the kingdom of heaven. America is just, it's a human setup that is working reasonably well, as all human setups at their best can do. It's got all kinds of problems. But that American approach to things that says it's, your ethnic background doesn't matter to whether you can be an American. It matters in as much as, sure, you know, celebrate your heritage, have a great St. Patrick's Day, you know, enjoy your Oktoberfest or your, you know, your, you know, have a good time at Diwali. Do the things that your culture does. Great. But none of those are a disqualifier or a qualifier for whether or not you can be part of a common conversation working toward the common good. America is a human construct invented by human beings trying to figure out a way to live together as neighbors mm-hmm. without going through what for the founders was pretty recent memory, the religious wars of the 17th century and all the horrors of, you know, and, you know, they deeply feared Christian nationalism. You know, what Europe arrived at was who's the region, who's the religion. You know, have that compromise, and let us please God put in the past, you know, the nightmare of the 30 Years' War. And, you know, so you had compromises like the Treaty of Westphalia that worked out things like that because Christians had shown themselves spectacularly unable for a long time to live in peace. And so one of the great achievements that I think that the founders were able to achieve was they put that in the rearview mirror. You know, you for all of its failures, we didn't have that on our soil. And yes, we have had plenty of other, you know, we've had genocides, you know, against Native Americans, and we've had slavery, and we've done, you know, we've done horrible things that we are still ashamed to look in the eye. But, you know, that's one of the ways in which human beings react to their own sin sometimes. It takes them a long time to be able to go to confession and say, I did this. I'm ashamed of it.
Well, Mark, this has been awesome. I know we went a little bit longer. We're experiencing some technical difficulties and stuff. My last question would be, I know this is such a heavy topic and it's confusing. And as you write in your article, your really wonderful cover story in the September issue, you know, it's a growing problem. What would you say the invitation here is for listeners during our own social and political climate?
That the focus has to be always, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you shall love your neighbor, including your Christian nationalist neighbor, like yourself. And then go out and do the next practical thing to make that happen.
Again, that was author and blogger Mark Shea discussing his September 2024 cover story in the St. Anthony Messenger, The Dangers of Christian Nationalism. You can check out Mark's work at markpshea.com. If you would like to subscribe to the St. Anthony Messenger, visit franciscanmedia.org and click on the subscriptions link in the banner. Once again, huge thanks to Mark Shea for being on the Off the Page podcast from Franciscan Media, and thanks as well to Father Cyprian Concilio for providing the music for this episode. This is Stephen Copeland signing off. Peace and all good.
I will lead you into the desert with me and tenderly speak to